Aloha, I'm Bill Dorman in This Morning for Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation. If you haven't voted yet, you have just about 8 hours to drop off your ballot or vote in person around the state. We'll update you on election activity, including why some Hawaii residents have been spending time campaigning out of state. And did you know that more than two-thirds of caregivers in Hawaii are immigrants? We'll take a closer look at how immigration is a national campaign issue with some very local potential impacts, plus some insights into Hawaii's beauty industry and how indigenous innovation is affecting life in our islands. It's Tuesday, November 5th, Election Day. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Bill Dorman. We're about 8 hours away from polls closing in Hawaii, but we can't give you a foolproof prediction about how long it will be until we know the results, nationally or statewide. That's because here in Hawaii, election officials are expecting lines for in-person voting that may delay the initial state results, the so-called first printout. We'll be following that story on HPR today and tonight with our government reporter Ashley Mizuo, who has been on top of developments throughout this campaign. And she joins us this morning with another fascinating insight. This one is about some local folks active in politics spending some time recently off island.
Yeah, good morning. And I think it's really interesting because, you know, it's the 1 week before the election, and the Hawaii Democratic Party Chair Derek Turbin and House Representative Adrian Tam, they spent the weekend, you know, bundled in thick jackets canvassing in Michigan, not in Hawaii, but in Michigan. And it's part of, you know, several different Hawaii-based efforts to campaign in these key swing states likely to determine the outcome of the presidential election. Turbin emphasized his support for Vice President Kamala Harris and how important it is to be involved in those efforts.
Just so important to let Kamala Harris and keep Trump out of the White House. And there's nothing more effective than in-person campaigning, actually showing up to people's doors and campaigning in person, which is why we've decided to go to these crucial swing states to campaign for her.
And, you know, Turbin is, of course, referring to Michigan, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Georgia, Arizona, North Carolina, and Nevada, you know, some of which will be closing their polls in just a few hours. And those states matter because they teeter on the edge between electing Democrat and Republican presidents. And that's why Turbin also led another group of Democrats to canvass in Nevada last month. And he says that made sense because there are so many Asian American and Pacific Islander voters in that state that do have Hawaii ties. He said, you know, when he was walking around canvassing, he would see on, you know, some of the cards, like a Hawaiian Island sticker, yeah, or local logos, and that would really open up the conversation to talk to them, being like, you know, I'm from Hawaii too, and, you know, have that conversation. So that's what they were doing in October and this past weekend. But in-person canvassing wasn't the only way Hawaii residents, you know, helped campaign in these mainland swing states. Indivisible Hawaii, a grassroots organization campaigning for Vice President Kamala Harris and Governor Tim Walz, wrote over 180,000 postcards to people in those key states. They had 700 volunteers doing that statewide. Younghee Overly was one of the leaders of that, and she says, you know, it just feels really good to be actively doing something, especially from a place that's so reliably blue like Hawaii.
There is definitely even lingering satisfaction even way after election is over. So I'm glad that we started to do this, because otherwise I'd just be anxious.
Yeah. And so, you know, she says that it really helped, you know, mentally to be actually actively involved in the presidential campaign, even from all the way over here, being able to write all those postcards and lead that effort. And she said, especially over summer, a huge amount of interest grew. They grew from being about 50 people to that 700 in the past year. So, yeah.
That's really interesting. And, of course, it's been the case on the Republican side as well. There have been Trump supporters that have gone to continental U.S. and that have been done campaigns as well. But Nevada Nevada is particularly interesting because if you look at the demographics of the state, and it's a relatively high proportion AAPI residents, and of course the Hawaii connection is so strong.
Yeah, and I think that was a huge reason why that they decided that would be the place to go, and it's the geographically the closest to us, I think.
There's that too.
So I think they had their kind of pick of states that they thought they would be most, effective in, and that was one of them where they thought that, a Hawaii kind of like delegation of them going there could be really useful.
That's true. Hey, a bit closer to home, though, some complications really in terms of as we come to this election day and things involved here.
Yeah, I mean, we're expecting really long lines today. Mm-hmm. Here's Chief Elections Officer Scott Nago.
There's more people voting in this election than the last general election. We're seeing higher turnout for the in-person voting as compared to the primary election. So it looks like there's going to be long lines. So if you waited, be prepared to wait for in-person voting.
Yeah, and we're seeing a lot higher turnout than we did at this point in the 2022 general election. So we're definitely going to beat the voter turnout there, but it will likely not hit the 69% high that we hit in 2020 when, we saw a huge amount of turnout here in Hawaii. The high amount of in-person voting could be partially attributed to emails that the Hawaii Republican Party has sent out to members encouraging them to vote in person instead of by mail, although there has been no evidence of widespread voter fraud. Officials are also reminding people that if you haven't yet registered, you can do that online, and that you should do some research before you get to the poll so you're not standing there trying to make your decisions in the booth.
Hey, I've got a great idea. If you need help in doing your research, the HPR Voter Guide, and Ashley, you put together a series of explainers that really go through for whatever county you live in some details on that.
Yeah, and so that can be a really helpful tool to use if you're kind of confused still about some of those questions. People have until 7 p.m. to be in line to cast their vote. And if you haven't mailed back your ballot, you should put in a drop box because it does need to be received by the 7 p.m. deadline. And so we'll be waiting around to see when the results will be released.
And we'll have more of that later. We've been talking to HBR's Ashley Mizuo. You can also check out her sizzling piece on 10 election stories we're watching. It's on our website right now and can help you through some of today's statewide developments. You can find it at hawaiipublicradio.org, along with the rest of our election coverage and voter guide. And if you've been following us on social media, you know that we've asked listeners to share their election experiences with us. Josie Bitgood emailed us and said, "Our family voted earlier this week, and I put the ballots in the Kaneohe drop box." Mona Peck also wrote us, "I voted by mail and was emailed that it was received 2 days later in Honolulu. I'm confident my vote is being counted. What's scary to me about this election is more filled with hatred and rancor than any election I can remember. I first voted in 1968, and this election I'm worried with possible riots, deaths, and harm to regular voters. I worry that the Republicans, if they win, will end democracy as we know it." We also received this voicemail.
"Hi, this is Jamie from Kailua-Kona, but I'm currently calling from Rhode Island. I cast my ballot, and I'm very excited because this is my first presidential election, and also simultaneously very, very nervous about the upcoming national election because there's a lot of political questions that will be answered in the upcoming term. And so very hopeful for the outcome on Tuesday, but also feeling a lot of nerves. Thank you."
And finally, this email from Rick Tabor. "I voted in every election dating back to 1975. Shoots, I even voted from overseas back in my field medical hospital corpsman marine infantry days. Serving our nation, supporting our democracy, participating in the process, staying active, gathering the truth despite the spin, staying grounded in the common ground, bridging to solutions, is a privilege and a duty I take seriously. We've also learned how important being involved in one's democracy can enhance our sense of self-esteem, sense of empowerment, and feelings of confidence. Move out of the blame and hate rhetoric. Stop with the someone should do something. We're each someone. Peace and love start from within. Love, live, aloha. Know you voted, the rest will do what it'll be. And in 4 years, we'll vote again for another president. Last but not least, life is 10% what happens and 90% how we respond. Remember to breathe." Thank you for your voicemails, your emails. We'd love to hear more. You can send us your thoughts on Election Day by calling our talkback line, 808-792-8217. Or you can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
An enclave of Armenian Christians has lived in the Old City of Jerusalem for centuries.
The Armenian presence in Jerusalem dates back to the 4th century.
Now the community says it's facing an unprecedented threat, a legal dispute over a controversial real estate deal that has the community worried for its future. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1, here on HPR 1.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
On this election day, many of the issues that have been central to the national campaign resonate in a particular way here in Hawaii. That's the case with immigration, both legal and undocumented. For a local perspective on this national issue, I spoke yesterday afternoon with immigration attorney Esther Yu. She's the director of the Refugee and Immigration Law Clinic at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii. We started our conversation on the links between immigration and the economy, both nationally and here in Hawaii.
In this election, voters have indicated, especially Republican voters, that the economy and immigration are two of the top issues that they are thinking about. I think what's missing from the dialogue is the fact that immigration plays a huge role in our economy and also in Hawaii's economy. You know, one of the examples that I think about is when hearing voters discuss their problems or concerns about today's economy, they talk about food prices and how in the last couple of years, food prices have gone up and it's hurting them in the pocketbooks. What I don't think that many voters think about or realize is that close to 50% of the food production workforce are immigrants. And I think about a quarter of that are undocumented immigrants. And so if Donald Trump went ahead and deported 11 million undocumented immigrants from the United States, our food production workforce would, 25% of it would vanish overnight. And what would that do, right, to our food production systems? So I think one of the disappointing things as an immigration lawyer is knowing that my clients work essential jobs in the U.S. economy, but their contributions are overlooked. And in the discussion, particularly in this election, the discussions about immigration and what's best for U.S. U.S. immigration policy is very much divorced from the discussion of what's best for economic policy in the United States.
That link between immigration and the economy here in Hawaii, particularly, you look at the most common job for immigrants here in Hawaii, and it's overwhelmingly, it's in one area, and it's the hospitality industry.
Hospitality, yes, exactly. So immigrants, foreign-born residents make up a huge proportion, a huge share of Hawaii's hospitality workforce. And some are lawfully here and some are not. And again, if this mass deportation scheme were to be effectuated by the Trump administration, Hawaii would see a direct impact in the ability, you know, for the tourism industry to survive here without up to a quarter of its workforce.
And you made the point on the national level that food production is tied to immigration as well, and that's the case in Hawaii as well.
Exactly. So a lot of my clients I work in, for example, in the Kona Coast on the Kona coffee farms, picking the coffee beans. And immigrants are also involved in the food processing sector. So across the nation, you know, meatpacking processing plants, other types of food processing plants, the large share of workers in those factories are immigrants, undocumented and documented. They're also involved in the transportation of food and also in retail. And specifically for Hawaii, I was doing my research before I met with you, because one area that I think about in particular for Hawaii, and obviously everyone knows about the tourism industry and its importance to the Hawaii economy, but another really important industry is the caregiving industry, because we do have an aging population and many of them do need caregivers. And I looked up, there's a study that was done by the Harvard Medical School where they found that 70% of caregivers in Hawaii are foreign-born. That's a huge, huge percentage. These caregivers are, they're vital, right? Without caregivers for our elderly and for our children, many of us who are U.S.-born and educated professionals would not be able to go to work, particularly women, who are often given the caregiving duties when they can't find a caregiver for their parents.
You know, one of the things about elections is that it's a snapshot in time, and it makes everyone take a look at that moment in time. But we're talking about trends here. We're talking about the future and how the future is developing, and very specifically how Hawaii's future is developing. And if you disrupt the immigration piece of this economy, it has severe consequences for Hawaii's future.
Right. And I think, again, that hasn't come out in the discussions about the economy during this election. And it's one of the things that I find, you know, unsettling, is this disconnect between the discussion about immigration and the discussion about the economy. And one of, I think, my roles now that as an advocate is to make people more aware of how vital and intertwined our economy and our society is with immigrants and immigration.
And what do you see, if you can prepare or lay the groundwork for what may or may not come next for you? How are you looking at this election?
So other than checking the news every 5 minutes and reading polls like everyone else, in my mind, so I was practicing immigration law during the first Trump administration. So if Trump were reelected, I think immigration lawyers have a good sense of what is likely to happen. And there are different levers of power that the president has to change immigration policy. They range from executive orders like the Muslim ban, and Trump now has a template. After 3 attempts, he finally refined it enough to pass muster with the Supreme Court. There are other actions that are more squarely within the executive branch's power. For example, he could end temporary protected status for many of the countries that currently have that designation very quickly. And then, of course, he can throw more resources into enforcement as opposed to U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which grants immigration benefits. So he could put a lot more resources into the side of the Department of Homeland Security that enforces immigration laws, as he has threatened many times to do during his campaign. In my mind, I can think of all the different ways that life could be different under his administration. I will say that as an attorney, I'm probably preparing for it just by mentally bracing myself. I'm going to continue doing my job, which is to defend immigrants in immigration court, try to seek relief where it is possible, relief from deportation. But I will just have to expect that I will be doing a lot more of it under his administration. And then the second part, I think, for a lot of immigrant advocates is that It now needs to become part of our role to change the narrative nationally and locally around immigration and immigrants. And I think that's one piece that could use more work on our parts, because we understand the system, we understand the needs, we understand the ways in which our laws and our immigration legal system could be better adapted and modernized to fill the needs of our society now and our economy now. And so I think part of our job is to educate and advocate and start changing narratives around immigrants.
No matter how the election comes out, the national dialogue about immigration seems to have shifted. Is mm-hmm. that true in your view? And if so, how?
Yeah, definitely. I think that, you know, when Joe Biden was running for president, he was running, making campaign promises in the area of immigration that were very much in reaction to some of the policies that were implemented during the Trump administration. So a big one was family separation during the Trump administration, and that provoked a really large public outcry. So I believe that President Biden wanted to appear to be more humane. Unfortunately, you know, there was a sort of a surge in numbers of people coming to the southern border, and politically, that's never been a very popular image, you know, that splashed around. And so I think in reaction to that, his administration has implemented policies to restrict the numbers of asylum seekers that can come.
What are your biggest challenges here in Hawaii in terms of the immigration issues?
I do think that, especially in Hawaii, immigrants and even undocumented immigrants, because of Hawaii's diversity, they can remain invisible. They can sort of blend into the population. And on one hand, that makes it feel safer for undocumented immigrants in Hawaii. On the other hand, it makes invisible their contributions to this place. You know, the fact is that immigrants not only work in essential jobs for Hawaii's economy, but they themselves create additional demand for goods and services, so additional spending. They also pay taxes, which I don't think a lot of people outside of this field really understand, that even undocumented immigrants do pay into the payroll taxes, the Social Security and Medicare taxes. They pay state and local taxes as well. So they are making enormous contributions to our economy. And also, a lot of people, they don't realize, you know, that their friend, their neighbor, their caregiver, their child's classmate might be undocumented, right? And so I think one of the challenges surrounding the discourse around immigration in Hawaii is that people don't really understand or realize how much of our society and economy actually depends a lot on immigrants. Whoever wins, there's a lot of work to do in terms of changing the dialogue around immigration and also the tone and the tenor of it. So that it's not as polarizing, but in fact, you know, just helping people to realize that there is a place for immigration in our economy and society. Now, the levels of it, you know, is up for debate, but you know, just being able to have a reasonable, fact-informed discourse would be a huge sign of progress, I think.
We've been talking with Esther Yu, Director of the Refugee and Immigration Law Clinic at the William S. Richardson School of Law at the University of Hawaii. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
What makes indigenous innovation unique? And how can traditional Hawaiian practices help us fix our world today? Those are some of the questions that organizers hope to address at a conference this Friday at the Hawaii Convention Center. The University of Hawaii will spotlight what its Office of Indigenous Knowledge and Innovation has achieved after 5 years, focusing on scientific, economic, and social initiatives. Kamala Inos is the director of the office. He'll present the opening keynote, along with Kuha'o Zane, the creative director at Sig Zane Designs and president of Edith Kanaka'ole Foundation. The conversation's Maddie Bender spoke to Inos and Zane about their perspectives on indigenous innovation. Inos starts us off.
I'm from a family of activists. My father, Eric Inos, and many of his peers occupied land in the 70s in Waianae and brought water down to start restore kalo farming and a whole bunch of other things around it. You know, it's one thing to occupy land and bring water down and start growing kalo in the 70s as an active resistance. But if you start doing it over time, you got to keep the lights on. Real mundane issues like HR, payroll, insurance, and fundraising for that was like, well, how do you fund aloi kalo? And true being raised in that context, going to college, getting a degree in Hawaiian studies, and then working, learning from the Kanaka'ole Ohana really, really deeply, moving over to Ma'o Farms, working as a director there for many years, getting a master's in urban and regional planning, studying community-based design, and like, how do we do startups, and for going a PhD and then sitting on a billion different Hawaiian organization boards to see how they were trying to position, how they talk to funders. The really intriguing thing that came back to us, we were talking about restoration. They were talking about our work as innovative. And we're like, we're not trying to innovate. We're trying to restore. But, you know, I think me and Kuo have a strong entrepreneurial hustler, Keoka Hawaii gene. We got to pick up what people are putting down pretty quickly and like, oh, okay. Why are they calling this innovation? Our sciences and technologies were about regenerative systems. So in ancestral times, your economy was your ecology. The same practice that fed you also made your aquifer recharge. It fed you estuaries. Like from a business lens, for one investment, you get multiple ROIs. Oh my goodness, this is an aha moment. So that is what we brought over to university to start the Office of Indigenous Knowledge and Innovation up to do. The general premise of our office is ancestral practices are sciences and technologies that have thousands of years of R&D, and they optimize for how people live within a carrying capacity of their landscape, working within a family unit. And by helping the Office of Research guide how research is done, we've had research examples. When I was at Ma'o, where a macroepidemiologist, Dr. Lika Monokia, studied the gut microbiome of our students there. And because we send young adults to from mine at a college, we're running the daily operations of organic farm. The study of the gut microbiome found that they're 50 to 60% less likely to develop type 2 diabetes. This was the first time I saw research that wasn't just studying Hawaiians to tell us we're sick again as part of like the business model. Like we publish, tell them you're sick, get things in, publish again. And you're not really creating solid interventions for the community, but just highlighting the nature of the problem. Or like extracting our knowledge and acting like you can own it. Or you're trying to save us. But we saw it was the first time where the research was being done to affirm a community intervention, moving something that was once anecdotal to become peer-reviewed. And within the business model of the university, it was a win-win.
I would probably add on that I think for me, I don't come from the academic world at all. For me, I definitely came from the retail side of things. And so I kind of had to learn how to like survive in this capitalistic economy. And at the same time, still with both of my parents, when they started Sig Zane Designs, the main goal or the main mission of it was to be able to share cultural narrative and to be able to share cultural education through the platform of retail or through the platform of design and clothing. Nowadays, you know, there's a lot more native Hawaiian designers out there, you know, that's cool. And I think that having the ability to design beyond just the aloha shirt, and now we can do architecture, now we can do interior design. Now, I would say beyond just adding a layer of narrative and adding a layer of aesthetic onto it, now I would say what kind of indigenous perspectives can actually improve the structural approach of a building? What kind of cultural lens can improve urban planning? What kind of cultural lens can improve soil health? In halau, I've been dancing for 32 years now, but I danced for at least 18 years before I got to choreograph my first dance. And so for me, that's just a case study of, in indigenous contexts, you have to go through the rigor of tradition first before you're allowed the privilege of innovation. And so for me, I would look at this opportunity of a conference like Indigenous Innovation is to actually share our groundings and our foundation, and then also the innovations that grew or sprouted from that.
What was the process like to get some of the speakers and presenters and panelists together? I imagine they must have been really excited to showcase all of what's been going on.
Actually, it was pretty easy. It was all the staff. So the intention of this summit is not to say, oh, this is what innovation is, and gatekeep and be like, no, this is the only thing. It is more of an accountability. The Office of Indigenous Innovation has been in existence for 5 years. Here are three flagship projects. So the three panels, the first panel will be focusing on the Center for Indigenous and Innovation and Health Equity, which is basically the idea of the Mauleola study I talked about earlier. We created a whole center around it, where how do we create opportunities for research to show ancestral practices preventative health. The next presentation will be on our Indigenous data with our new director, Rochelle Robley. The second presentation will be focusing on our Indigenous data visualization centers, which pair traditional practice with contemporary 21st century visualization tools, 3D mapping and projection walls. And the third will be talking about the center we're standing up that shows how Indigenous innovation can drive social innovation in Hawaii. It would be a showcase of Indigenous organizations that are driving social change in Hawaii. Ma'o Farms, Purple Maya Foundation, Kuha'o, and some of the work he's doing in Kumumikiala Lidstone. And the final panel will be presenting on initiatives that the Office of Research has begun because the Office of Indigenous Knowledge's inception. And me and Kuha'o are going to be the opening keynote, where we try to provide context for the whole day.
I'd love to hear more, maybe from Kuha'o, just of like the perspective that you feel like you're going to add to what otherwise is in many ways a very academic seeming lineup.
You know, I think for me, the part that I bring to the table, one is that the foundation portion of like, where are we at currently when you're looking at cultural understanding? It's funny because I was in our preschool the other day. We have a little charter school and a preschool is a part of it, but I took a picture in there. It actually shows that we're teaching our Hawaiian scientific understanding in our preschool. And I was blowing my mind because at the same time, I'm doing workshops with some of the largest corporate entities in Hawaii teaching this same context. And so for the first time, what we're teaching in our preschool and what I'm teaching in corporate, it almost levels the playing field of access to information. And then I would say the second portion of it is I would hope to bring just a level of applying our concepts of innovation in an economic context like today. How is some of our innovation applicable today in our current society?
Were you surprised by the feedback so far? You shared that you're oversubscribed, you know, hitting the physical limit of the space at this point.
I wasn't surprised. I was actually very not to be arrogant at all, but just because this is Office of Research's annual conference. And we've been helping for the last couple of years design the narrative around it. 2 years ago, it was on water, where we had Red Hill conversations. We talked about pre-contact history of usage of water, really robust conversation. Last year, it was focused on circular economy with Dr. Kumana Beamer and Kate Raworth. And each of those have began to be progressively more well attended. But I also think there's a moment in time, to quote Einstein's maxim, that the mindset that created a problem can't be the mindset that solves it. That me and Kuha'o's families and those that came before us worked so, so, so hard to normalize that we can express our Hawaiianness without fear. The forces that were compelling us to divest ourselves and to become American were so strong. And we lived through people are afraid of the apocalypse. Hawaiians live through our apocalypse already. We lived through our societal collapse. We came out through it the other side. And we lost 90% of our population and our monarchy. And we're still here. And I think we're not just here hat in hand. because of the resilience of those that came before us, it gives us deep insight. The world is an island now. It's super hard to like be isolated. We have, as Pacific Islanders, 3,000 years of R&D of living on islands as we migrated across the Pacific. The world is hot. We lived on hot islands. And what I feel is the most important thing of indigeneity is like the land is your ultimate teacher. And if that to me is what people are coming to realize, then I'm really excited that our indigenous communities can be set up at the very least as consultants to help with the transition and eventually executives in a way that our children aren't fighting for representation anymore. They're doing the bigger fight of implementation.
Is there anything else that you want to add or that you want listeners to sit with?
I hope the word indigenous is an invitation. Indigenous doesn't mean brown people. It means continuity. And everyone is indigenous to someplace. And if you're in a space where indigenous people exist, you make the world better by supporting them in the restoration of their practices, because you know these practices have been proven to create ecological and social balance. But also that it can be a point of inquiry if you're not indigenous to a place about the incredible things that your ancestors did and like how they saw the world. And those decisions make up your physiology. They make up your psyche. And I think there's so much acrimony in the world right now. I think one thing is the restoration of identity does it silences some of the noise of differences bad. And how do we honor our differences in a non-performative way by dignifying our own ancestry while dignifying others? I hope that that can be part of stabilizing the world we live in right now. And that may be aspirational, but I don't care.
We had one of our largest ceremonies in our halau yesterday, actually. It's one where we take care of the altar that we have within our halau. Yesterday's ceremony, one of the most prevalent things that I felt is that this was the strongest feeling of transference of information that I've had in my head to the next generation. And for me to be able to feel that so strongly this time also adds a nod of urgency that if there is information that is held within these past generations, and especially with the current generations of Kupuna that we have currently right now, that there is a sense of urgency to be able to learn and to be able to listen as much as possible. And so I think that this conference is an opportunity, and like what Kamu said, an inquiry and an invitation to be able to listen and to learn as much as possible.
Kuhaho Zane and Kamuela Enos talking with HPR's Maddie Bender. Friday's conference on Indigenous innovation is at capacity, but will be live streamed. We'll have more information on the conversation page of our website after the show.
Support for HPR comes from Blue Note Hawaii. Kailua-born reggae artist Irie Love and Friends perform a tribute to Bob Marley and the Wailers in two sets this Friday. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Today is Election Day, and HPR is here to help you. Check out our free voter guide at HawaiiPublicRadio.org/vote. Tell us your thoughts about the election. Leave a voicemail at 808-792-8217. Election coverage begins today at 2 p.m. here on HPR One.
Support for HPR comes from TS Restaurants and its Legacy of Aloha Foundation, supporting the Maui community and assisting those affected by the wildfires. More about how to help by searching tsrestaurants.com Legacy of Aloha.
And now, a little break from the news. It's time for the Manu Minute. And we've got the call of the ringneck pheasant, courtesy of Zeno Canto. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo Professor Patrick Hart.
The ringneck pheasant, also known as the common pheasant, is a well-known game bird that's native to Asia and was introduced to Hawaii as early as the 1850s. Males are particularly striking, with a bright white ring around their neck, chestnut brown body feathers, a red wattle, and a dark, rich, metallic green head. Both males and females have long tail feathers with characteristic black bars running down their entire length. These feathers are often used by local feather workers to create headbands and often adorn paniolo hats. The song of the common pheasant is a distinctive two-note cock-er that's only sung by the males and isn't nearly as impressive as their plumage. This is a welcome sound to bird hunters during hunting season on the main Hawaiian Islands. Common pheasants are mostly found in agricultural areas or non-native grasslands, where they eat a variety of seeds and insects. Their Hawaiian name is kolohala, which means to creep along, and reflects how hard they are to find in the tall grass, where they're often not seen until they burst into flight when closely approached. Pheasants are one of the few birds that are actually still being imported to Hawaii. The Put and Take program, run by DOFA, uses money from hunting license and bird stamps to import young pheasants from North America to Hawaii, where they're kept in captivity until they mature and then are released for hunters in the state game management areas. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Hawaii Forest and Trail, offering guided nature adventures on Hawaii Island, designed to help inspire connection and stewardship of the land. More information at hawaii-forest.com.
The global salon services market is estimated to jump in value from $230 billion in 2023 to $380 billion by 2030. That's according to Fortune Business Insights. That growth is being felt here in our islands. It's led to the creation of the Aloha Together Group, or ATG. Its purpose is to build a stronger hair industry in Hawaii by creating more opportunities for local folks. Vincent Holloway is ATG's Vice President of Marketing and Media. He's also a graduate of the Hawaii Institute of Hair Design and has been a barber for 8 years. The conversation's Russell Subiona sat down in our studio with Holloway, who grew up in Brooklyn, New York, and is better known to his clients by his nickname, Smurf.
The level of talent and even the influence that we have from, you know, the mainland has directly affected us in a huge way. I think from what I've noticed that being a barber nowadays or being a stylist is not really seen as a hobby kind of a job no more. Now it's actually trained professionals, not only giving a haircut, but you have to know so much more than just cutting hair that nobody had really, you know, really dug into or even dove into. With the different abilities and the different programs that's out here now, man, the beauty industry is really just exploding right now with talent. And, you know, Hawaii is a very special place, and we would love to help push, you know, the talents that's here on this island further out and to get more exposure.
You mentioned a little bit earlier how things are on the mainland. How does that industry there, or what's going on in the industry there, how does that influence us?
It seems to me that a lot in the mainland, especially, you know, you start from the East Coast, even the West Coast, you know, those styles of haircutting has evolved to the point to where here we are in Hawaii and we're constantly seeing those haircuts and seeing the styles. Even though the island might be a little behind, still those are styles that we strive to learn and that we're getting better at, you know, at a faster rate.
Pretty much everybody gets a haircut, right?
Yes.
Why do you think our local hair and beauty industry has grown? Do you think it's just tied to numbers, tied to the population? I know you just talked about ideas and trends coming from the mainland as well. What are some of the other factors as to why we're seeing this growth in our industry here?
Well, I think that a lot more people, especially in my division, you know, the male hair industry, being a barber, more guys are being more aware of their looks now. Even with the guys that, you know, that really don't care about getting their haircut every so often, now it's become more apparent that guys are actually starting to take care of themselves now. Not only with just hair cutting, but now they want to do facials. Guys want to get their nails done. You know what I mean?
Right.
So it's really good to see from that standpoint that guys are kind of trying to step up their looks as well.
Yeah, I noticed that was one of the big trends here in Hawaii, maybe starting maybe like 5-10 years ago.
Yes.
This kind of rise of upscale barbershops that cater to men. Yes. Places like The Parlor, where you work.
Yes.
Places like Mojo and other places. They have a much more like masculine aesthetic, right? Yes. The colors are more are darker. There's sports on TV. I think somebody serves beer.
I have heard that. I have heard of those places.
Yeah. And they're all kind of this updated version of that old school barbershop you see in movies and TV. Right. What's your recollection of how these kinds of shops have started opening on Oahu?
You'll be surprised that a lot of guys don't normally go to a regular barbershop like, you know, The Parlor, The Collective. Some might just go to, you know, let's say a Great Clips or
Fantastic Sam,
stuff like that, you know, and that's perfectly fine. But now you're starting to see like even a lot of social media gurus or influencers, a lot of guys are coming in wanting curly hair now, you know, so we learn how to do perms. You know, we have to learn how to do color. So it just seems like now is the time where guys are really starting to, you know, care, you know, just as much as women, if not more so now.
I mentioned earlier you cut hair at The Parlor. Yes. How long have you been a barber?
I've been a barber for going on professionally for 8 years now. Yes, since 2017. Went to the HIHD, you know. Yeah. That's the barber school that everybody pretty much went to out here, you know. Shout out to Leo and to the school for, you know, really molding the industry as it is now. Because I would say most barbers and stylists went through them, you know.
I've been going to you for haircuts since 2018.
Yes.
So almost...
Yes.
Well, almost 6 years.
Almost
6 years.
Yep.
I've only known you as Smurf. I only recently found out that your name was Vincent Holloway. What is the story behind Smurf?
Okay. So, you know, me being from, you know, Brooklyn, New York, my favorite color was always blue growing up. Always. You know, even with Yankees, you know, go Yankees, the Giants, their colors are blue. So blue has been my color since I was a kid. Nobody ever remembers my name, Vincent. You know, they come to the shop. Hey, is that one guy that was cutting my hair the last time? I forgot his name. Smurf. Yeah, that was him.
Yeah.
But if you say Vincent, nobody understands who you're talking about.
When we look across the industry, across Hawaii's industry, how much of it is big chains and how much of it is independent, local, small businesses just kind of serving their community or trying to make a living?
I would say is maybe about even almost. With the rise of, you know, barbers and stylists, you've seen the rise of shops opening up as well.
Yeah.
But you will always still have those corporate shops that will always continue to do good, you know.
Yeah.
But yes, due to the rise of stylists and barbers, the rise of shops has, you know, been up a lot, you know, within the past 7 to 8 years that I've noticed, you know. And it's great to see. It's really great to see.
Yeah. Small business is the backbone of any economy.
Yes.
And it's been interesting to see a lot of small shops open up in the hair and beauty industry.
Yes.
Not just barbers, but I see makeup people.
Yes.
People that do, you know, like eyebrows and other types of services like that.
Yes.
And so it's been interesting to see how kind of widespread and broader the industry has gotten.
Yes. Yeah. So even going back to the school that, you know, that we went to, they wasn't teaching how to do nails when we were there. Now here we are. Now they're teaching them how to do nails as well, coming straight out of hair school. So now it's not only a hair industry no more. It's an actual beauty industry. So, you know, that's what, you know, the All Together group, that's what we're all about, trying to bring the whole industry of beauty together as a one whole and just try to get as much outreach as possible and try to, you know, shed a little light on Hawaii.
One thing I wanted to ask you is, with so many of these businesses that are small businesses and coming to a better understanding of the workforce that's behind the industry and the businesses that are within the industry, it seems that there may be some opportunity for the public to maybe kind of miss or misunderstand the day-to-day life of the people that are in the industry.
Right.
What do you think the public might not understand or realize about the state of today's industry that maybe they should know more or better?
I would say the professionalism has been stepped up. It's not really necessarily, oh, I'm just going to go into a shop and just get my hair cut no more, right? So now you have to actually sit down, and the barber should actually want to get to know the client, not just, oh, I'm just going to cut your hair and get you up out of here because it's all about money. At the end of the day, we're here to serve, yeah. right? We're here to provide a great service, not only provide a great service, but sometimes just be an ear, just to listen, you know, to what somebody has to right. say. Sometimes that goes a long way. And at the same time, it's a give and take. I do believe in fair balance, you know? If you're going to be a barber or a stylist, you have to be on time. This is a business at the end of the day. And you do have to cater to your surroundings and to your community, yeah. you know? It's been a blast. And I think, you know, as we continue this journey, it's only going to make us better. It's only going to make us stronger because iron sharpens iron, right? So that's what we're hoping to achieve here.
It seems like in today's day and age, there's more license to express yourself than probably ever before, yes. right? A lot more people walking around confidently in the way they dress, mm-hmm. in the way they look.
You're right.
And like hairstyle, I feel like is such a big part of that yes. too. So yes. in your day-to-day, when you're cutting people's hair, mm-hmm. how much do you see that factor into the style that people have or want? The idea that they express themselves through the way they look.
All the time. All the time. I'm a huge believer in, you know, when you look good, you feel good. And depending on the person and their personality, as well as their job, you know, whatever factors that might take into account of whatever hairstyle that they might want, that's what translates into what me as a barber or stylist would have to try to match that, you know. You see young kids. Everybody wants the mullets, the fur hawks, you know. you know, got a lot of the brothers from the West Side. They still do the, you know, the high skin fades and, you know, stuff like that. You know, here in town, more longer hairstyles. But it just goes with the time. And as a barber or a stylist, you have to be really flexible and open-minded to learning a lot of these different hairstyles.
That's the kind of thing that barbers do for you, right?
Yes.
The kind of, they listen to you
yes.
and they bring out kind of an inner part of you
yes.
out to the outside.
Yeah. Yes, 100%.
Can you give our listeners the information on how to attend the expo?
Perfect.
And what they can expect when they go?
Perfect. All right, so if anybody wants to attend the Hawaii Hair and Lifestyle Expo, all you have to do is go to the www.altogethergroup.com or you go on Instagram, ATG, and we got a way that you could hyperlink that could send you straight to our website and you can go book from there. We have flyers around. If you could go to Sally's Alta, they have our flyers hanging up and they have a QR code. Pull up the QR code to your camera, straight to the website, and you go ahead and book tickets straight from there. And this is for everybody. It's not just for us barbers and stylists and estheticians. We always hear all the time, it's hard to find a good barber. Yeah. It's hard to find a good stylist. It's hard to find that. Well, we're making it easy for everybody by putting everybody in one room.
Right on. Vincent Holloway, I know you as Smurf.
Yes, sir.
Thanks so much for coming into the
you.
Station.
Thank you. I really appreciate you for having me. Thank you. This has been a blast.
Barber Vincent Holloway, better known as Smurf, talking with HBR's Russell Subiono. The family-friendly ATG Hawaii Hair and Lifestyle Expo takes place this Sunday, November 10th at the Neil Blaisdell Center. We'll have a link to more information on the conversation page of our website later today. That is our program for today, but stay with HPR for Election Day coverage today and tonight. NPR special coverage begins at 2 p.m. We'll join with local updates after polls close around 7. Tomorrow, we'll have a post-election live call-in show. Our government reporter, Ashley Mizzou, will be back for that, along with local political analysts Colin Moore and Neil Milner. Share your comments or questions with us about what you're hearing, your election experiences. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217, or you can email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Bill Dorman. Thanks for joining us. Mahalo, and join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.